Alan Kring Productions presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 2 for Autumn Semester 2018. Lecture 21, delivered on November 6, 2018. The title of this lecture is Cost of Capital.
Today, the cost of capital. A few things to start with here. The stock market, as we enter the beginning of trading for the day, we're still seeing the futures prices being posted at a... Okay, you tell me. What's going on up there?
It doesn't seem as bad as some of the other days that we've seen, but it doesn't seem good.
Yeah, we had only a couple of volcanoes and a meteorite hit this morning. Yeah, it's a quarter... The thing that is notable, though, and I've brought this up several times, is the broad base of the decline. You're not seeing some up, some down. You're seeing they're all down. And it's a quarter, and then the NASDAQ's down more. But that, of course, is largely due to the fact that the NASDAQ has riskier stocks in it than a typical portfolio. Now, as I have said before, if you are betting on politics as a motivator of stock markets, you're stupid. The markets really don't care too much about the political environment from day to day. The Wall Street boys are hoping for one more party and all of that. But other than them, whatever it is the expected outcome of today's elections, that's not a particularly important thing to stock market to trading. They're more interested in trends in the economy and the leading stocks and what they're doing, which can drag down other stocks along the way. So the movement this morning has little to do with the expected outcome of the elections this morning. Let me move on here very quickly. The yield curve. As I said, we are looking now more at this guy right here, the 3 to 5 year. Notice that it was the 7 to 10 year that was really important there for a while, but that thing has opened up quite a bit. It's at 8 basis points. Where the action now is, if there's going to be an inversion, is right here in the 3 to 5, which is now standing at 4 basis points. That could close fairly quickly over the next week. If it's going to close, I would not be surprised if you don't see something invert by the end of next week, possibly before that. And then you've got the signal that a recession is coming. So keep an eye on the 3 to 5 year. It's an important marker right now, which is interesting that it's gotten itself closer in. There was something else I was going to mention this morning, and I cannot remember what it was. There was something about the stock markets over the weekend that was notable. Can't remember what it was. I want to show you something here. Before I get started on the cost of capital, I do want to show you a minor note about the capital asset pricing model, CAPM. This is something that I would bring up also much more in a later class than this one, but I bring it up in this class because with the capital asset pricing model, the expected return, and this is an expected return, even though I don't write it as that, is a risk-free rate plus the beta of a stock times the expected return to the market portfolio minus the risk-free rate. This part right here is called the market premium over risk-free, market premium. Now, don't get confused. There are a couple of problems in your homework this week where they'll say the market premium is. So they're already calculating that piece. the expected return to the market portfolio minus the risk-free rate. That's already being calculated, and you're being given the number right here. But if they say the expected return to the market portfolio is and the risk-free rate is, you have to calculate it yourself. Let me show you something here. This is actually just a plain old, well, let me take this. I want you to go back in time to your dark memories from the past, those ones that you try to keep out of your mind. You know, you push them back, and someday it finally comes all flooding through, and you have to tell your therapist about it. Yeah, I'm talking about linear algebra. Yeah, right? You might remember somewhere in your dark past, someone gave you this y equals mx plus b, the slope-intercept form of a line. Yeah. And you push that out real fast because you'll never have to use it again. Well, here it is, suckers. strangely enough, the capital asset pricing model is nothing but this equation right here, y equals mx plus b. The slope is this expected return to the market portfolio minus the risk-free rate. That's the slope of the line. And the y-intercept is the risk-free rate. It's nothing but a stupid line, linear equation. Watch, let me do something. Suppose that right now the expected return to the market portfolio, let's say it's standing at about 8.4%, and the risk-free rate is, let's say, about 2.67%. I dropped that off the board so I can't see what, but I'm using maybe about a one-year treasury bill for the risk-free rate. So in other words, the market premium would be 8.40% minus 2.67%. I'm not even going to try to calculate that because I've been so bad at arithmetic lately. I don't know why I'm, but okay, calculator. Okay, 8.4 minus minus 2.67 equals 5.73. So in other words, this, the expected return to a security, or whatever you want to say, discount rate, whatever it is you're looking at, would be R sub F, 2.67%, plus the beta of the security times 5.73%. Let me rearrange it. Bear with me. Whoops. 5.73 beta sub s plus 2.67. That's y equals mx plus b. That's a linear equation. Matter of fact, we have a special name for this thing. It's called the security market line. It's kind of important. Because what I can do is once I have this equation, you can tell me the beta of a stock, any stock or project or whatever, and I can tell you what its expected return should be. So in other words, this is nothing but y equals mx plus b. So if I were to draw this, with beta as the independent variable and the return to the stock as the dependent variable, R sub F at a beta of 0, that's R sub F, and a beta of 1, there it is. That's the capital asset pricing model line. So you can tell me any beta and I can plot it. I can tell you exactly what the return is to this project. You give me any beta at all, and I can do it. Now, obviously, as time changes, this security market line is going to move around because R sub F is going to change. The expected return of the market portfolio is going to change. So it'll be moving through time. But it's basically that line right there. Now, next thing I need is, madam, what kind of a beta person are you? Well, give me a beta. I want a beta. 0.8. 0.8. So now I can say, all right, if I were to take 5.73 times 0.8 plus 2.67, your expected return, your portfolio's expected return with a beta of your portfolio of 0.8, your expected return should be 7.254%. That's what your beta on your portfolio should be. That's what you expect it to be. Madam, are you a, let's say you're a risk taker. You're cray-cray, you know, crazy. I mean, when people order at the Mexican restaurant, you say double hot sauce. You know, I went to this Indian restaurant in town that have 0 through 5. I don't know why I did it, but I said 5. You know the guys that made the food, they were actually peeking around to watch me eat it. It was wrong. I mean, magma coming out of my face, and, you know, I really kind of missed that bone, those bones in there that disappeared. Yeah. Anyway, so let's say that you're a beta of 1.7. Okay, you're very risky. Okay, the expected return to your portfolio, what you expect it to be, is, in this case, 2.67. Whoops, clear. I'm sorry. We would say 5.73 times 1.7 plus 2.67. Now, by the way, there are a couple of problems. I'm doing this partly to show you there are some problems in the homework that you'll run into just like this. So your beta, so your expected return should be 12.411%. There you go. So you see, you can tell me any beta, and I can tell you what I expect your portfolio to return. The trick, though, so this goes back to something I said earlier. Well, these people got the highest return of any of the portfolios. Well, that's wonderful. Tell me their beta, and I'll see how that worked out. Of course, you're going to have, as higher beta goes, you're going to get a higher expected return on it. That's how it works. So in other words, that beta of 0.8 would be around here, and this beta of 1.7, that should be a expected return up about there. Yeah, that's how it works. Here's the trick. You're not a hero if you're on the security market line. You've just taken a higher beta, so the physics of the security market line is going to tell you what expected return you should get. So you got a high expected return, well, spank me. You took a high beta, it's right on the line. That's just math. That's not hero. That's not genius. What is genius, or actually anti-genius, is what happens if you took a 1.7 beta and you got a return of, let's say, 14.2% instead of 12.411%, you would be off the security market line. You would be, instead of here, you would have gotten a return up here, which is off the line. If you've got a portfolio that's off the line, either up or down, we have a number for that. 14.2 minus 12.411. Let me do that. 14.2 Oh, well, let me do this. Memory save. 14.2 minus 12.11. 12.411, was it? Try that again. 14.2 minus 12.411. That's positive 1.789. Positive 1.789. We have a name for that thing. It's called Jensen's Alpha. Jensen's Alpha measures how far off the security line you are in your real portfolio. You see, you have the theoretical, you should have earned 12.411%. Your portfolio actually earned 14.2%, so you had a positive Jensen's Alpha. That is what you should be measuring. And also, you could also have a negative one, too. Suppose that this portfolio here, your expected return should have been 7.25%. Suppose that it was 7% instead. That would mean that you had a negative Jensen's Alpha of 0.254. There's a website, you might have seen me go to it a couple of times. It's called Seeking Alpha. It's a play on that. They're seeking the positive alphas there. Yeah, their humor. I mean, finance humor really sucks, but it's subtle. But that's what we talk about. A Jensen's Alpha measures how far from where you should have been you actually got. Now, normally, you're going to have slight positive and negative Jensen's Alphas. That's just normal. The theory is going to have some haze in it, some stochastic, you know, random noise. But normally, your portfolio might one year have a somewhat positive Jensen's Alpha. The next year, it might have a slightly negative Jensen's Alpha. Where you look for when you're looking for a fund, a mutual fund, or an ETF, when you're looking for a mutual fund especially, you look for a manager that can hold positive Jensen's Alphas year over year over year. They've got magic. Now, most of them are going to just say, well, our portfolio returned. Well, get past that. So what? That might have been just the beta taking you there. But if the beta took you to a slightly lower than the what you actually saw. In other words, if a fund manager says, well, we earned 8.9% on our mutual fund this year. Okay, let's look at the beta of your mutual fund. The beta says that it should have earned 8.7. Okay, you had a positive Jensen's Alpha. Not spectacular, I mean, that's within the range. You really are interested in Jensen's Alphas above about 0.75% to 1%. That's where you're seeing someone who's really outperformed the market. In other words, outperformed what should have happened. At your age and your health, you should be able to lift 200 pounds. Dude, do you even lift? Okay, sorry, I just had to ask that. Okay, suppose you lift 500 pounds. Whoa, you've got that's a 300 pound Jensen's Alpha there. I'm impressed. Okay, and if you can do that three or four times, well, that's good. But if you do it once, well, that was just an accident. Something happened that morning. You got into your friend's stash of Wheaties and didn't know that he'd put some extra in there, you know. But I mean, if you could do it over and over again, that's where you've got something that is beyond the normal performance level. And so when you're looking, I can even show you, and I will do that on Thursday. We'll look at mutual funds, and there are these rating services. They don't show you just what the mutual fund earned. They show you the Jensen's Alpha on it. And then you can see for yourself, is this fund manager doing a good job over and over again? Because they'll show you like a five-year Jensen's Alpha on the mutual fund. Then you know this is a good portfolio. If someone brags to you, well, I got my portfolio earned such and such, well, la-di-da, let's check the CAPM, see what it should have earned, and then we can see if you got a positive Jensen's Alpha. Sometimes you'll see someone say, well, I made 23% on my portfolio last year. That's pretty impressive. But then you look at the beta, and it turns out that portfolio should have earned about 28% because it was so risky. So no, that wasn't awesome. You had a negative Jensen's Alpha. Even though it looked like a big, high, positive return, you sucked. You took more risk than you needed to. So this is something to look at, and this takes you a little further into what we mean by performance in a fund and portfolio. Don't impress me with saying, I got this return. Show me that that return was more than what CAPM said it should have been, and then I'll be impressed by it. Now, cost of capital. And actually, you will find that the homework that you're going to have for this chapter is surprisingly easy. You do have to watch out for a couple of things in it, though. But see how much you remember from the dark. Madam, what do I mean? What do I mean when I say capital? Is there something else that I could be other? Is there any other kind of funds I could have besides capital? Okay. Okay, is there any other type of funds other than capital? Say yes. Very good. Okay. What is that other type of funds? There's capital and there's money. Money is short-term funds. Capital is long-term funds. Okay. Now, this kind of, when I get you to this point, I'm taking you into the world where we're talking about capital. That's long-term funding. And first of all, you've got to talk about where we get capital. And also, to some extent, what we mean by the term capitalism. Capitalism. I wrote on a message board once, I really don't have a good definition of capitalism. Some genius came in and referenced me to Wikipedia. You have to be nice on these message boards. I said, you dumb left buttock. God, you're stupid. First of all, Wikipedia. And second of all, you're talking to someone who's a professor of finance who says the word capitalism is just kind of like, well, we believe in capitalism. Actually, communism and socialism are much easier, much better, more clearly defined than the term capitalism. What is that? Is there a capitalism for long-term players and a moneyism for short-term players? Capital in and of itself just means long-term funds. And you are in a company, we have to have long-term funds. We get short-term funds when you, for example, you run a pancake restaurant and I buy pancakes from you, a 3-stack, you know, with extra butter and maple syrup and maybe bacon on the side, 8 or 9, 10 strips of bacon, crispy but not completely crispy. I want it a little bit soft on the fat part. Anyway, focus here, okay? When I pay you with money. That money is probably going to be used to pay the light bill, pay your employees. You're going to put some of it away if you can retain some of it. Then you're going to reinvest that in the company or give it to your owners as a dividend. But for the most part, that money is going to be paying the bills. Short-term money, short-term liabilities. Okay? But we do have to have money in the long run, okay? There are a couple of places we can get money. One place you can get money, of course, is, you know, see if mom and dad have any. If that doesn't work, you know, you can rob a bank. But if we're in a company, we got to do it legitimately. Okay, there are people like Gates and Soros and Buffett and people like that who didn't, but and Jobs, but there you go. Okay, and the Koch brothers. So anyway, we can borrow money. In other words, we issue debt paper. We issue debt paper. Now, this can come in all kinds of different flavors and varieties, as you've seen. There is the debentures, there is the mortgage bonds, there are the senior bonds, there are the callable bonds, convertible bonds, gold bonds, foreign bonds, and there are notes, of course, and we have junk bonds, investment grade bonds. It's debt. And we can raise capital through this process. One interesting way is to not pay our bills, which increases our debt load and frees up money for us to be able to use for projects. If I don't pay a bill, that's money that I have to do something else with. Kind of avoid that one. In this one, debt. You're going to see a problem, and I'll bring this up on Thursday's lecture. Okay, this company has debt, raises debt for its projects. Okay, what is the cost of that debt? Cost of capital is always going to be a percentage. The problem with using the term debt is which debt? You'll notice in the problems that you see that I've put in the homework, I say their cost of debt is, but that's actually kind of not really true. What cost of debt? Is this the cost of their senior subordinated debt? Is this the cost of their notes? Is this the cost of what? In general, the term debt is going to refer to the marginal debt, the last debt, the most expensive possibly debt. When Netflix first started raising money, it's got debt at a very nice low coupon. But recently, the debt that it is, the money it's raising through debt is costing it quite a bit more because the cost of debt has gone up on this company because the company is riskier and riskier. The more it borrows, the riskier it gets, the more the investors want that coupon to reflect that risk. So when I say debt and the cost of debt, unless I say otherwise, I am referring to the last debt, the most expensive debt also. So in other words, what is the cost of debt capital in Netflix? I'm not going to look at the coupon on some bond it issued 3 years ago. I'm going to look at the yield to maturity on the notes that it has just issued recently. Again, I will not look at, well, what's the coupon rate on their debt that they've had outstanding for a few years, maybe 5 years, 10 years, 20 years. No, I'm going to look at what is the cost of the most recent debt they have issued. And in terms of percentage, I'm not going to look at the coupon. I'm going to look at what the market wants that cost to be, the yield to maturity. Because the next time that company goes out to raise money, it is going to be at least the yield to maturity. So the next time Netflix goes out there and raises money, guarantee you it's going to be raised at or above the current yield to maturity on that paper that it just issued recently. And what's even worse about that is now that we are beginning to go into, we're going to start sliding into a recession, interest rates in general are going to go up, which means that the price of Netflix and all these other companies, of their bonds, are going to go down, driving their yields up. So the cost of debt capital is going to go up as interest rates in general go up. Now, the other side is equity. There are so many different kinds of equity. Sir, what is the most important kind of equity funds, equity capital? What's the most important kind? Got nothing? You're up. What's the most important kind of equity capital? The company cannot survive if it cannot raise this kind of equity capital. Huh? Well, not exactly, but what do you mean by cash? He said cash. So what do you mean by cash? Go back to the pancake restaurant. What did he let me have my pancakes free? No, this son of a bitch, he's a capitalist. I go in there and say, I need free pancakes. Well, and that, you know what really torqued my boxers last week? Denny's tried to give me a senior discount. Oh. I mean, I just cussed and swore at that. I know. Although it was a generous one, and you know, what the hell. Anyway. Okay. It's internally generated, your retained earnings. And that's a bad term. Don't ever use that in a real finance class, but accountants. It's how much money you're making at your business after you've paid your bills. That's the most, if you can't, in the long run, raise equity capital, internally generated equity, what belongs to the shareholders after all the bills are paid, you're out of business. Although, Lord knows, some companies have tried to stay in business, just borrowing and borrowing and borrowing and selling stock. But the most important kind of equity capital is what we call internally generated. What's left after your bills are paid? The money that you actually earn doing what you do. Now, the bad term, the really bad term for this that you're going to hear is retained earnings. It means internally generated, but I can guarantee you, don't do this to a real finance person. I love the story I've told many times about at this board meeting, they had executives and they had some junior executives in there, young pups, a few years past you, and they were talking about how they were going to fund a project, and this one younger fellow said, well, we can fund it out of retained earnings. And one of the senior officers said, son, I want you to leave and find our checking account that says retained earnings. Once you have found that account and we can write a check out of that account, then please come back to one of our meetings. But until then, don't ever come back to one of our meetings again. The kid never went back to a meeting again because there is no such thing as retained earnings. There is no such thing as retained earnings. It is a mythical thing that simply gives us a placeholder for accounting purposes to explain where net income goes after you've paid your bills, after all that, and where net income goes after you have paid your dividends. The remainder adds to the existing retained earnings to make new retained earnings, which is part of book stockholders' equity. But it doesn't exist. However, you'll hear that term from time to time, and now you know that if you ever hear that term and I'm in the room, you might want to just kind of put your head down or leave the room until I'm finished with the idiot who says it. Retained earnings doesn't exist. It's like when you were growing up, were you ever told about the boogeyman? If you got out of bed, the boogeyman was going to get you. He was in the closet, and if he heard you get out of bed, he'd come and get you. Well, my parents told me that. My grandparents told me that. They lied. He was under my bed. Stepped out of there, and the son of a bitch almost ate my foot. Okay, the other one is externally generated. Now, don't get comfortable, because there are a couple of kinds of this. That's selling stock. Now, there are a couple of different kinds of this. There is common stock, and there is, as I said, it used to be more popular than it is now, preferred stock. I will tell you one thing right now, and you'll see why this is true very quickly. But this externally generated equity is expensive because you have to pay the people that raise the money for you. And I've told you a story about, we rainmakers will hit people for terribly high costs in doing that. Let me show you a basic problem. You need $500,000 to run a one-year project. That will generate $595,000. if the float on new capital is 5%, what is the ROI on this project? This is virtually identical to one of your homework questions. And I like this one, to show you this one, because at first, this is one of those where you don't, if you don't see what to do here, there's nothing wrong with you. It's confusing at first. It's essentially this. Look, I need $500,000. The rainmakers are going to take 5% of whatever they raise. So in other words, I need $500,000 is going to equal 95% of some amount of capital, X. You see, because they're going to take 5%. In other words, $500,000 has got to be left after the rainmakers have taken 5%. So $500,000 has to be 95% of what the rain was. And doing that, I come up with $500,000 over 0.95 is going to be what the rainmakers will pull together for me. So in this case, 500,000 divided by 0.95, 526,315.79. 526,315. Is that right? That seems like a hell of a, that's the kind of stuff that I would do to people. Okay. In other words, that 526,000 and change is going to be $500,000 we need after the rainmakers have taken their money, their 5%. Okay. That's what they need. That number does not look right, but apparently it is. Okay, anyway. So now we can say what's the ROI on the project. It's 1 year, so this will be easy. 595 and over the beginning, we raise $526,315.79. And that's going minus one. That will be our return on investment. In other words, we pulled $595,000 on an investment of $526,315.79 minus one. So our ROI was 13.05%. That was our ROI. And that's almost identical to one of the problems that always gives people difficulty in this chapter. But you see, by the way, notice that the higher that float is, the lower your final return on investment is, because more and more of your money is being eaten up by the rainmakers. This is what happens when companies go out and they raise money through selling, doing IPOs. That is about the worst way in the world to earn money, raise money, because you're paying so much to the investment bankers that any punch that capital gives you is going to be weakened by the fact that you had to raise so much extra because of paying the float. This is one of the big problems with these private equity funds. These idiots will take floats of 20-25%. They'll save your company. But you have already lost 25% of the punch. Look at what would have happened to this ROI if private equity fund jockeys had been involved there. Look at what would have happened if that had been a 25% float. Let me show you that. Let me show you why the private equity funds are one of the worst things in the world for a company that's trying to grow. Let's take $500,000 and say that's only 75% of how much we're going to have to raise because we've got to pay 25% to the rainmakers. In this case, 500,000 divided by 0.75 is going to be the X. And in that case, we've got 500,000 divided by 0.75. We've got to raise 670. You're going to lose all the project will be a failure. Do you see that? If you're going to make $595,000, oh, gee, yeah, let's run up and borrow or raise $666,000. No, you're going to fail. This is Sears. This is Staples. This is a whole line of old companies that bought into the grifters that are doing this stuff. They're raising so much money, you can't have a positive ROI. In this case, you're dead. You're going to make $595,000 on the project. Wonderful. Oh, it's going to cost $666,000 to do it? That ain't going to happen. You're going to have a negative ROI. Company fails. Sears did that. Staples, a whole line of companies over the years. A lot of restaurant chains that were actually doing okay until the private equity people got a hold of them and started playing games. Okay, there you go. So you see, that's one of the dangers, is the float already hurts you. Now, I will tell you something interesting about this. Oddly enough, if you're earning money internally, you're selling your product, keeping some to reinvest, that's going to be the cheapest form of equity because you don't have a float. You're not paying investment bankers to raise the money. Interestingly, the next best kind is preferred stock. Historically, the float on preferred is surprisingly low. It's just, that's the way it's always been. Also, when you raise money through an issue of debt, we issued $10 million in bonds. Interestingly, the float on bond issues is quite low as well. The one that is just the costly as hell is raising money through selling common stock. It is the one that will kill you. And yet companies do it. And when I was, even to this day, my first question, well, this company is going public. It's going to sell common stock to the public. The question I have is, why in the hell? Write down what I'm about to say here. Hint, hint. First, if you're raising money through common stock, you're going to pay a float that will guarantee that you will lower the return on investment. Second, suppose your stock price could be high or it could be low, and I brought this up before. High or low? If you're raising money by selling stock, would you sell stock in your company when the price is at its peak or at its bottom? Bingo! You would sell the stock when you have calculated that it's about to fall on its face. So you're going to sell the stock to these people when internally you project that it ain't going to go any higher. Because if you wait, it's $50 a share. No, I think we'll wait until it falls to $10 a share to raise money. Yeah, no, you're not going to do that. You're going to sell the stock when it's high at its highest level. Another one that is easy, okay. I have a secret place where there is a gold treasure. I'm not kidding. I actually do. Okay. Now, I'm going to share my secret with you because I'm that kind of a guy. Mm-hmm. You're going to be a part owner. By the way, kick in some money so we can go and get this treasure, okay? Oh, I don't have any money, but I've got the genius. I'm the thinker here. Okay, you in, brah?
No.
Okay, you cynical generation, damn millennials. Why are you selling ownership in a company that's going to be a winner? You just borrow money. Because borrowing money, you pay back a fixed amount. With equity, the people you take on ride the wave with you. This is three reasons right there why you should be suspicious of public offerings of common stock. Yes, of course companies raise money through stock. Yes, of course people make money by buying common stock. There's no question about that. But that does not mean that you just go in and say, wow, it's common stock, I'm going to be an owner. You got to be careful of that, because the world is full of people like me who would be very happy to take your money for an extra martini at lunch. You remember that when you play with the boys on Wall Street. They're not in this to make you happy. They're in this to make the other rich people happy. So when they start an IPO, they're going to make sure that the issue goes to their richest clients first. And then they're going to hype that. And then when the stock price goes up, they're going to pump it out to you fools and then let the stock price drop while their rich clients made a killing on the IPO. That's how it's going to work. Well, my stock price went up from $100 to $110 last year. I made a 10% return on that stock. Ain't I a genius? What was the beta of the stock? Use a CAPM. Show me that you did a Jensen's Alpha that was positive. You probably didn't. You thought you were a genius, but at the end of the day, you're holding one little gold nugget while the Wall Street boys are walking away with bags of gold. If that doesn't scare you off, nothing will. Here's the thing, though. You know, over the last couple of years, I've talked to people who are professionals still in the business, and I said, why isn't preferred stock very popular anymore? And mostly there's kind of this shrug, well, for one thing, there's no sex appeal in it. Preferred stock is sort of like bonds. They just sit there, day, 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 and they just keep paying you. So there's not really, unless you're really seasoned as a professional, you're probably not going to raise money through preferred stock because of the lack of appeal it has. It's just not interesting. Although you will find that real estate investment trusts still use preferred stock. Very quickly, REITs, real estate investment trusts, they were authorized in 1961 or 60, they were originally created as a way to move the America of the 20th century forward. After World War II, we wanted to get people into their own homes, into housing that was nice so that they could live the American dream. We also wanted to start up nice shopping malls and all that stuff that was considered valuable to the great American dream of that era. Stable neighborhoods, good pay, all the good stuff, and a nice home, and you know, shopping at a nice little strip mall or an indoor mall. So this tax structure was created. Here's how it works. Okay. I start an REIT. I get investors to put money in. I use that money to build, let's say, a shopping mall or an apartment complex or a housing subdivision. Then when I make sure that this happens fairly quickly. By the end of the year, I've done it, I've made the money, I've had a one-year investment, and then I take the equity, how much I've made, and I distribute at least 95% of it back to the owners as special dividends, I pay no taxes as a corporation. I have a zero tax liability. So in other words, I sell preferred stock to you. You're a very wealthy investor. I use that money to buy a strip mall. I rehab it, bring it up to a vacancy rate, down to a vacancy rate that's good, clean it up, do all that stuff, and then I flip it. And let's say that you bought $500,000 in stock from me, preferred or common. What I do, and I pulled off $1.5 million. Off that, I pay back to you 95% of that $1.5 million at least, and I got no tax liability. And then I can go, and you'll love it. You'll invest in me again. You'll hear about it. You'll invest in me. REITs are like giant souffles. They just keep issuing stock and then bringing properties in, building them, flipping them, and then they give the money, distribute the money back as a dividend, 95% of it, and then they go on. Those same owners are still there for the next round, but I bring in new owners. Almost sounds like a pyramid, doesn't it? They work. They're amazing. Unfortunately, in recent times, well, okay, let me tell you one that was I actually was consulting for. I saw it firsthand. It was one that actually had essentially a single investor love this REIT. And there was a mall, a shopping mall in Kansas City. This was in Columbus, Ohio. They flew out to Kansas City. The shopping mall was going to run at about, they were going to be able to get it for about $600,000. They went out there, inspected, said yes, and then they called this Japanese bank, said, here are the specs. They faxed over the specs. That was before the internet. And faxed over all the specs, photographs, all that kind of stuff. Within about 20 minutes, the Japanese bank manager in charge of these kinds of things said, okay, we'll wire transfer the money, and you issue the stock to us in the usual way. They had a whole protocol for it. The money was in the REIT's bank account the next morning. They bought the strip mall. Within 4 months, they rehabbed it. They brought back its tenancy rate really nicely. And I saw pictures of it. It was really nice after they'd gotten it all cleaned up. They flipped it, and they flipped it for close to, it was about $1.5 million. And they just issued a dividend to the Japanese bank for 95% of that. Amazing. And then I went and looked in the books. This Japanese bank had been doing this for like 5 years. There were millions and millions of shares this Japanese bank had simply bought to give the company money to flip back to them after they cleaned up the properties and sold them. That's REITs. Unfortunately, now they've been perverted. The biggest players are now, they have gotten it so that the IRS doesn't bat an eye. There's Bank of America was in here, one of their representatives. He was their REIT specialist. And I said, what do you guys do REITs? Oh, he said, oh yeah, we love prison REITs and forest REITs. What? Forest REITs. They buy a forest, mow it to the ground, take the money, the proceeds, and of course they flip that back to another division of Bank of America that funded it tax-free, and then they sell the ravaged property off to developers to put houses on that. Or they buy public prisons that have been abandoned, and then they rehab them, sell them off to private prison companies that then contract with the state to house medium and high security prisoners. And then they flip the property, and then when they flip it, they sell it from that REIT, but then Bank of America, another division, which was the original investor in the REIT stock, gets the proceeds tax-free. Yeah, about that. Anyway, so there's equity and debt. Now, the cost of capital. Now, this is very complicated. R sub D, that's the cost of debt. R sub E. That's the cost of equity. There are three kinds of equity. There is the cost of existing stock. There's the cost of new common equity, R sub E. And then finally, there is the cost of preferred. There are actually three costs in equity. Now, two things about the cost of debt. Your interest is tax deductible. So we don't talk about R sub D. We talk about the after-tax cost of debt, which is the pre-tax cost of debt times 1 minus the company's marginal tax rate. So in other words, if a company is in the 40% marginal tax bracket and it pays 10% pre-tax, it pays 6% post-tax. So that's all that matters to us is the after-tax. And do not get me started. Okay, I'm already started. A company in a high tax bracket gets cheaper after-tax cost of debt than a company in a low tax bracket. So in other words, some company that has a 40% tax bracket, 10% after taxes is 6% to them. Me, my low-life, piss-ass little company is in a 50% tax bracket, so 10% for me is 8.5% after taxes. In other words, our tax laws favor leverage the larger the company is. The bigger the company, the more favorable it is to use debt in your capital structure. Now, if you think about that, that really is not a good idea. Okay. Yeah.
Wouldn't that just be like an incentive for a company to try to get bigger?
Oh, yes, it is. It's sort of like the whole idea of there are economists, right-wing economists, who say, let's lower the tax bracket the richer the people are, because that will give poor people who are getting their asses taxed off an incentive to become richer so they don't have to pay so much tax. It's sort of the idea of, let's starve you if you're poor, and that gives you an incentive to make a lot more money so you can eat, you know. But, okay, let me show you something here, okay? This That's a little company failing because it borrowed too much money. Now, get ready.
Oh,
yeah. Mosh pit! Ah! Oh, I'm going to hurt something I care about. Which is more dangerous to your economic well-being? Yeah, you see, when you leverage big companies, you are putting it's gotten to the point, literally, we have these banks that are so huge, they have borrowed so much money that they are too big to fail. We can't let them fail because if we let them fail, our entire world ends. Well, it doesn't end. It just gets kind of apocalyptic, you know, with, you know, the shooting scenes and the zombies and Okay, so you see that there is a problem with this whole concept because we've created monsters, literally about a dozen monsters that they were given such an incentive to have debt in their capital structure because it was so much more attractive than equity in their capital structures. And I'll show you this on Thursday. I'll show you a couple of banks. Their debt to equity structure is disturbingly tilted toward debt. And of course, we can't let them fail now, even though they are completely inefficient. They are basket cases. We've shoveled about $15 trillion into these banks since 2009. Actually, it was since 2007 it was going on. And we can't let them fail now. And it was one of the reasons was that there was such an incentive for high marginal tax corporations to borrow instead of issuing equity. But there you go. That's the way it works. The next thing is to talk about weighted average cost of capital. I will tell you about that on our next lecture. That's all I have for you. I thank you.